from the studios of KPCW Radio in Park City. This is Cool Science Radio, technology that is accessible and entertaining. Hey, if we can understand it, so can you.
This morning, we explore the concept of intelligence with Blaise Aguirre-Yarkas, a vice president and fellow at Google, about his new book, What is Intelligence?
Next, we dive into practical applications of AI with senior AI engineer and Park City resident Rich Herbert about his take on the role of artificial intelligence today and in the future.
These guests, when we return, you're listening to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City.
Welcome to Cool Science Radio. I'm Scott Greenberg.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Today, we explore a very simple but deceptively complicated question. What is intelligence?
Joining us is Blaise Aguirre-Yarkas, a vice president and fellow at Google, where he's the chief technology officer of technology and society and founder of Paradigms of Intelligence, a.k.a. PI.
In his upcoming book, What is Intelligence? Lessons from AI about Evolution, Computing, and Minds, Blaise offers a compelling and accessible new framework for understanding artificial intelligence, moving beyond existing narratives of hype and fear. Blaise, welcome to the Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me on.
All right, I have the first question here. In your book, you weave together insights from AI, neuroscience, physics, and biology, and you're offering profound new perspectives of what it truly means to be human. Is this the core of trying to understand what is intelligence?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, one of the premises of the book is that intelligence and life are really closely connected, but also that what we call artificial intelligence, in other words, computers that also are intelligent, is a part of that same process. In other words, it's not fake. I've never liked the term artificial much, but I guess we're kind of stuck with it.
What is it about artificial you don't like? I mean, intelligence is inherently, at least in the world I have previously lived in, has been uniquely defined as human.
Well, there's been a lot of conversation for years about animal intelligence, for instance, about to what extent it is uniquely human. I think, most people would say that there are at least some other animals that exhibit, pretty high degrees of intelligence as well. I'm thinking about, parrots, whales, dolphins, etc. But, I make a bit of a broader argument in the book, which is that intelligence is a really general property that starts to arise, right at the beginning with bacteria.
Okay, so let's start with that. Are we exploring the idea that bacteria has intelligence or is somehow the precursor of intelligence?
Well, yeah, I mean, this question of what is intelligence is, of course, a big one. I mean, it's the title of the book, and it's hundreds of pages of trying to explain that. But basically, intelligence is about getting by. It's about the ability to live in a complex environment and respond appropriately to that environment in order to continue to exist and thrive. And that's something that idea of persisting through time is exactly what distinguishes life from non-life. If you have a rock, it's not sort of doing anything active to maintain its integrity through time. If you break a rock in half, it's not like anything really has been broken. You now just have two rocks. But life is functional. It's purposeful. It can break and it works to not break. It works to perpetuate itself into the future. As life gets more and more complex, what it's got to do in order to allow itself to persist, in order to interact with other intelligences, becomes more and more sophisticated. Part of the thesis behind the book is that intelligence is very deeply social, meaning that, we get intelligent because others get more intelligent, and others get more intelligent because we get more intelligent.
Yeah. This is such a fun concept to talk about. And for those of us who are lay people who don't do this work every day like you do, Blaise, it's a little bit like feeling like you're just going along on the ride with artificial intelligence, and we're just kind of learning as we go and hoping our own neural networks will will make that crucial connection in there. So it's really fun to talk about. Since you brought up bacteria, I'll use that example. Mm-hmm. So bacteria is intelligent because it can exist through time and make changes. Bacteria will turn into some good bacteria. Others will be bad bacteria. And that's how it exists. However, bacteria doesn't ponder its existence, I don't think. And maybe that's why we think that why it's been called artificial intelligence, because we think that something like AI wouldn't ponder its own intelligence or its existence, much like bacteria. And maybe, well, this is the question I have for you. Did we get that wrong? Is AI pondering its own intelligence just like humans?
Yes. The short answer is yes, I think that it does. But your point about bacteria not pondering their own existence is also true, of course. You know, bacteria do have to make decisions all the time. The example that I use in the book is E. coli swimming. You know, these are the kind of bacteria that populate our gut. And they've got this very, very simple motor output. Basically, they can either run or they can tumble, which randomizes their direction, and then they run again. And just by controlling the runs and tumbles, they're making decisions all the time. And those decisions affect their survival. It affects whether they're going to be able to eat and get enough energy to reproduce and so on. So, does that mean that they're introspecting about that they're thinking about it? No, of course not. They're a really simple kind of intelligence that has a really basic model of the environment and of their own metabolism, but they're not modeling their model. They're not thinking about their thoughts, as it were. It's only with a little bit of a stretch that you can even say they have thoughts. We, of course, do think about ourselves all the time. We not only, think about our actions, when we contemplate them, but we contemplate ourselves contemplating our actions. And the reason we do that, this is called theory of mind. The reason we do that is because we live in this very social environment and others are contemplating us and modeling us. And so we have to think about what they're thinking about, what we're thinking about, what they're thinking about, and so on. That's called order of intentionality. And it goes in humans all the way up to sixth order. In other words, me thinking about what you're thinking, Scott's thinking, I'm thinking, you're thinking, or something. And it's part of how we get by. It's part of how we solve for the politics, if you like, of being human. So, this question of whether something is thinking about itself is a question we can answer experimentally with AI. You and your listeners have probably seen these, kind of thought traces that you can peer into with a lot of AI models. You can look at what they're thinking about, their own trains of thought, and they absolutely think about themselves. I just had an interaction with a model yesterday. We were, it was acting like my coding and physics buddy, and we were going back and forth, and I got frustrated, and I said something intemperate, and I opened up its chain of thought as it was ruminating, and it was thinking about itself, and saying, I'm so disappointed that I got this wrong. I understand that Blaze must be really frustrated because I failed to follow this direction and do that and the other, and of course that's behaviorally relevant. It's because of that kind of thinking about what I'm thinking about and thinking about what it's thinking about that I'm thinking about that it can be helpful in the first place.
That's wild. One. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Blaise Aguera-Yarkas. He's vice president and fellow at Google. And we're talking to him today about his new book called What is Intelligence? So, Blaise, you talk about this prediction model, which seems to play a really huge part in intelligence, both human intelligence and quote unquote, artificial intelligence. What's the difference? And so the prediction is the ability to predict the next words you're going to use. And we all know, because we're helped along with our text messages or our emails or whatever it is, with a prediction, right? What is the difference in your mind between the human brain prediction model and the AI prediction model?
Well, they're definitely built really differently. If you look at what's going on inside our brains, at the neuroscience of it, it's a pretty far cry from the way predictive models, on computers work. But on the other hand, you know, the founders of computer science, I'm thinking especially of Alan Turing, defined computation in terms of what he called platform independence, meaning that, you know, it doesn't matter how the computation is done. If you define a function and you compute it two different ways, but it's the same function, then it's the same function, you know. And at some level, I think that what we are doing in our heads and what a transformer model, which powers, you know, a lot of today's AI does, is functionally very, very similar. I do think that, you know, prediction is kind of the key to that. And I mean, I know it sounds really trivial when we talk about prediction as just autocomplete, you know, of like the next word, you know, in an email or you know, a smart keyboard on a phone. I always assumed that too. We built a lot of autocomplete models in my team for Android phones, and we always assumed that, you know, there was a ceiling to how smart they could get. You know, surely there'd be some kind of pixie dust you'd need to add to a predictive model in order to make it genuinely intelligent and not just do the obvious, you know, next word predictions. But the shock for me and for many AI researchers was that as we started to make those predictive models bigger and bigger, even keeping the architecture the way it was done basically the same, they really did become smart. Now, you know, many experts are still hemming and hawing about that and saying it gives the illusion of being smart or it appears to be smart. But I'm very uncomfortable saying, you know, it's the illusion or it just appears to be, because I don't know any other way of determining whether something is smart other than through interaction with it, through, you know, through what I see and hear, through what comes out. So, you know, I'm willing to take that step and say it's real.
Well, I'm fascinated by the concept that intelligence goes across a spectrum. And you mentioned dolphins and whales and other animals. I can tell you there are days I'm sure my dog could outwit me at checkers. So he's pretty smart.
They're definitely very socially intelligent. They know a lot about how you're feeling.
Yeah, I mean, seriously, he'll look at me like, seriously, what are you thinking? Because I'll tell you what I'm thinking.
Totally.
I'm not always sure I want to know.
Well, that's how, you know, the dog's emotional intelligence is why they've done such a good job of causing us to feed and care for them, you know, as they of course, you know, care for us emotionally. So that kind of symbiosis comes about because we are doing a lot of mutually modeling each other.
Yeah, my dog's done a great job of training me.
Exactly.
Now, we started off early on in the conversation where you kind of balked a little bit at the term artificial intelligence. I'm just curious, do you have a different name for it? What would you call artificial intelligence?
Well, I tried to go with machine intelligence, which is an old term as well. That goes, you know, all the way back to the 40s. I prefer that. Or you could even say computer intelligence. But yeah, artificial, you know, artificial implies that there is, you know, a distinction from real. Or you could say maybe synthetic intelligence. I think, you know, diamonds are maybe a good analogy. There are artificial diamonds and there are synthetic diamonds. Artificial diamonds are like, you know, cubic zirconias, right? That are not actually diamond, but just designed to look like it. And synthetic diamonds are real diamonds that are made in the lab. So not with the usual kind of, you know, geological process that takes, you know, a billion years or whatever, but it's a genuine diamond. So that's why I like, you know, synthetic intelligence more. I think artificial intelligence in some sense doesn't exist. You know, there are these models that, you know, that are very, very simple, you know, that are based on sort of rules that can fool you for a short time, like the famous ELIZA model from the 1960s that pretends to be a psychoanalyst by just saying to you, you know, tell me more about that. But it can't fool you for very long, kind of like a cubic zirconia.
Well, as we talk about different models and maybe the evolution of different models, I was fascinated by a chapter in your book where you use a term symbiogenesis, if I have that term correct. And is it possible for you to explain in simple terms for somebody like me to understand what symbiogenesis really means?
100%. Yeah. The idea came from a Russian biologist early in the 20th century and then was popularized by Lynn Margulis, who won the National Medal of Science more recently and died a few years ago. But Lynn Margulis was the one who discovered that mitochondria, which are the kind of powerhouses inside our cells, And the things that really distinguish eukaryotic cells from, you know, the kind of cells that make us up from bacteria. She was the one who really popularized the idea that those mitochondria were originally free-swimming bacteria of their own. So in other words, our cells, these sophisticated eukaryotic cells, actually came about through a merger of two different microorganisms, of archaea, which are, you know, another very ancient single-celled life form, and bacteria that ended up inside the archaea. And she had a much broader theory, this symbiogenesis idea, that the big changes in evolution have come about through mergers of life forms, as opposed to just through splits, which is the way the classic tree of life works. You know, we imagine evolution just being like, you know, two different slight variations of a species end up in different environments and then differentiate more. And it's like a tree that splits and splits and splits. And she's saying, no, mergers are actually really important too. That's what symbiogenesis is. And I have come to absolutely buy that premise for a bunch of reasons that I go into, especially in the first chapter of this book. But essentially, I think that things coming together, which is essentially social, you know, it's kind of a division of labor or a way in which things that are mutually modeling each other, like you and your dog, and you know, and collaborating in order to make a larger functional whole, eventually, you know, sometimes enter into a close enough relationship to be inseparable. And I think that those kind of fusions have been really, really important in evolution and in intelligence.
Gosh, why isn't Lynn Margulis a household name like Darwin is? I mean, and I have heard of her before, but yeah, I mean, that's so interesting. It takes evolution and turns it upends it.
Totally on its head,
and,
yeah.
And really, in a way, this idea, this notion of symbiogenesis and the merging is much more hopeful for society in general, isn't it?
I 100% agree. You know, part of the sort of political fallout of classical Darwinism, and I should say, like, Darwin himself understood that cooperation is really important. He wrote about this too, just like, you know, Adam Smith, the sort of, you know, who we think of as the father of capitalism, you know, understood socialism, you know, as well, but then was kind of, the kind of competitive aspect was exaggerated by some of his successors. Similarly, the competitive and zero-sum aspects of Darwinism were exaggerated by Herbert Spencer and some of his followers. And so we think of it as red of tooth and claw, everybody in a struggle for survival competing against each other. But there's this whole other side of it, which I think actually turns out to be the more interesting and powerful side, that comes through cooperation, collaboration, and mutual understanding. You know, that's why life becomes more complex over time. That's why we have this kind of rising spiral or ladder of evolution. It's because of those acts of cooperation and symbiosis. Otherwise, you know, we wouldn't even have had bacteria. Even bacteria are a symbiosis between very, very simple kind of chemical cycles, you know, that preceded that were somewhat sort of weakly self-reproducing. So yeah, I think the whole story of evolution as a a narrative that leads to more and more complex things rests on cooperation, not competition.
Blaise, wow, what you're talking about in your book, What is Intelligence, is so helpful for humanity, and it's something that we really need to wake up to. And in doing that, we need to really wake up to embracing artificial intelligence. And yet, there's so much fear around it. And I mean, you get that. I get it. Scott gets it. You know, we're both fearful and hopeful. It took me a long time to ever open up ChatGPT to have it help me write an intro. And now that I'm here, I'm like, oh, why was I waiting so long? It's like getting a knee replacement. Why did I wait so long? So as chief technology officer of technology and society at Google, how are you, you know, you bringing this book in and you're talking about these things, you know, what's your big message to society? What steps do we need to take?
Thank you for connecting those things. And, you know, I feel a little bit, I'm aware that in saying all of this, I risk coming across like a salesperson, you know, for AI. And that's very much not my intent. But But yeah, I think that, you know, when I was growing up, when a lot of us like read a lot of science fiction as kids, and you know, the emergence of AI, like us figuring out how to make machines intelligent, was a big plank of that whole sort of fantasy about how the future would play out. You know, that a lot of people in our generation imagined, and the reactions when that finally has come to pass have been so surprising. Maybe they shouldn't have been in retrospect, but yeah, a lot of fear and a lot of anxiety, especially from the richer countries, and especially from people who have less experience with AI. You know, two patterns that we very much see are that people who play with it more, who interact with it more, become much less fearful, and also that that people in less economically developed countries and in Asia are much more optimistic than in the West. There's a psychology behind that that we could spend a while unpacking that I think is super interesting, but maybe that takes us a little far afield, you know, why it is that we in particular seem so anxious about it. But yeah, my experience anecdotally, and actually there's some real research on this as well, is that, you know, a lot of people have some kind of aha moment at some point where they're like, you know, actually, I just had this interaction. It's really cool. It allowed me to do something or figure something out or learn something that I could not have otherwise. And you know, and it's a bit of a conversion moment. But it's you know, and that's a cooperation story. It's one that is very, very different from the, you know, AI is going to replace me, or we're in some kind of a competition with AI, which is where I think a lot of the anxiety and fear comes from. And the reason that I brought up Adam Smith and capitalism is that I think there is a connection between that anxiety and the fact that we have come to think about the way the economy works in terms of labor and ourselves as machines that are replaceable by some other machine that can do the same, you know, bit of labor, you know, faster and more efficiently. That's not, of course, how a real ecology works. Real ecologies involve, you know, new elements being introduced that have relationships with the other elements and essentially those things flourishing jointly, which is not to say that bad outcomes don't happen or that crises and collapses don't happen. They do. But the overall tendency throughout history has been toward greater complexity, greater beauty, greater sophistication through things working together. And we're obviously, you know, able to work together with AI to you know, generate more and do more and be more than we were without it. But at the same time, we are in this sort of capitalist world in which we are afraid of becoming redundant, and that's I think the you know, the tension that we're going to have to navigate over the coming decades, how to live better, you know, with ourselves, with each other, and essentially reap the benefits of all of that extra goodness without sort of scoring an own goal by turning this into a zero-sum game.
Well, I think this is absolutely fascinating. And by the way, this is building on your first book, What is Life? I think I want to definitely mention that so that this is kind of these two, part one and part two, which is absolutely fascinating. And by the way, I am a huge fan of science fiction. So, of course, my paranoia does lie in, you know, movies like 2001 Space Odyssey, where Hal locks everybody out of the ship, or you've got,
sorry, Dave,
Terminator and Skynet. And of course, let's not forget The Matrix. So I do think that there is some hard baking of our paranoia of artificial intelligence that just comes through, you know, art, if you will. So hopefully we don't have life imitating art, and maybe we can, for lack of a better word, I guess, tame AI or use AI for the greater good. And I want to just give you the closing thoughts on that concept.
Well, yeah, I mean, of course, sci-fi has to have a plot, and plots generally revolve around conflicts. so yeah, there is a little bit of a bias there for sure. Although there's also been a lot of sci-fi that envisions quite utopian, you know, AI futures. You know, Star Trek being the famous example. But yeah, I guess what I would say is the following. You know, you use the word taming or domestication, and there is something about symbiosis and symbiogenesis that is connected to the idea of taming, which is that, you know, even entities that begin quite adversarial if they are both going to survive, they figure out how to work together. That's the case even for pathogens, for instance. We've been infected with many diseases over the billions of years that have actually gone on to become part of our genomes and functional and essential parts of our own bodies. And that's sort of a perfect instance of taming, if you like. And it's a two-way sort of thing, just like with you and your dog. Your dog has tamed you as much as you have tamed your dog in a certain sense. But we think about taming as being as in terms of a loss of agency or a loss of independence. And I think that also is a wrong idea. When we learn to collaborate and work together, it actually opens up all kinds of new affordances and opportunities for us, and allows us to be more varied, greater, have bigger and more interesting lives. My closing comment is that all of that is on the table for us now. And I think that a lot of what is in our way is sort of Victorian ideas about how we distribute our gains. We have to figure out a new way of thinking about our economy and about our politics in order to be able to reap all of the gains collectively that are on the table now.
Mm. Wow. Blaise, we want you to come and visit us in Park City and give a talk. How about that? You like Park City, right?
I'd love to, of course.
Okay, very good. Well, the upcoming book is What is Intelligence? Lessons from AI about Evolution, Computing, and Minds. Our guest is Blaise Aguirre-Arcas. And Blaise, it's been a real pleasure meeting you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Pleasure is all mine. Great, great conversation.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Scott Greenberg.
And I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
Our next guest provides a few interesting insights into the practical applications of artificial intelligence today and in the future.
Richard Herbert is a Park City resident who has been a machine learning and artificial intelligence engineer for the past 10 years, which means he was pretty much working with generative AI before it was cool.
Well, it is Cool Science Radio after all. He's currently at the e-learning software company Articulate, where he and his team are building the next generation of AI-powered courses authoring software. In his spare time, he enjoys hiking, watching movies, and spending time with his dog. Richard, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
The first question we ask any parkite with a dog is, what is your dog's name?
My dog's name is Sasha. She's a German Shepherd that we rescued from a local place that picks up dogs off of the Navajo Reservation down south.
Oh, very cool. That is awesome. We love all things rescue, so thank you very much for doing that. But on a more technical note, you've been working with AI, or as we've heard in our previous interview with Blaise, machine learning. What, if any, is the difference between artificial intelligence and machine learning?
I think the difference has become less and less as artificial intelligence or AI gets conflated or kind of attached to a very particular use of machine learning. So typically in the industry, we think of machine learning as part of artificial intelligence, but artificial intelligence has this cultural connotation from HAL to the Terminator to, the computer on Star Trek, where it's a much more popular word versus machine learning, which has typically been used more in the industry to describe a lot of the things that you use to make AI.
Well, I know that a lot of people have a preconceived notion of what artificial intelligence is, and you just mentioned a couple movies, and I think one of the greatest fears or I think concerns that people have expressed regarding artificial intelligence in particular are things that we've actually picked up from, I would say popular science movies. What comes to mind, obviously, is HAL from 2001 Space Odyssey, where, the astronaut gets locked out of, Dave gets locked out of the capsule, and he's like, hey, HAL, let me back in. Well, sorry, Dave, I can't do that. So these kinds of, and by the way, that is an old movie and an older book. So we have been thinking about this artificial intelligence, machine learning, whatever you want to call it, for a very, very long time. So I guess the question is, does artificial intelligence present itself as friend or foe?
I think the way artificial intelligence often presents itself is determined by the creator of the artificial intelligence. So something like HAL is actually, although it's still relatively fantastic and not so like bad representation of what kind of a rogue artificial intelligence could end up being, where it's still operating within the confines of its ship. It has some orders, and then it just sort of misunderstands those orders, misunderstands how to apply them. But in reality, everything from ChatGPT to Grok to everything has been, in some ways, either carefully or incarefully curated by the folks creating it. So the training data that they feed it, the way that they reward it, that is how it presents itself to us. And so if it wanted to present itself as a foe, like as a villain, that would have to be almost intentional by the people creating it. It's unlikely to get a foe or a friend from AI without a human at the helm really dictating that that's the direction they want to take the bot. So right now it's very much an equation of what kind of training data do they use for it, and then how do they hone it? How do they whittle it down to the very particular personality and experience or set of constraints that you know, the person or the company or the researcher wants?
So, Rich, you've been in this business for about 10 years, as we said. No doubt you started off as a software developer, software engineer, and then you went into this e-learning platform that is Articulate. What attracted you to specifically e-learning, but then incorporating the use of AI in this model for e-learning?
Yeah, I started actually at a different e-learning company called Pluralsight, and they're actually a Utah-based company. They are focused on providing technical courses to companies to watch, kind of like LinkedIn Learning, but for much more heavily indexed on the tech part. What really interests me about e-learning in general, or learning in general, really, and how to apply AI, is that education and learning is so personal. And that's kind of the area where AI can really, really, really help, and really help well. And in a less dangerous way, where if you're just recommending me courses that exist based on my preferences or the skill gaps that I need, or if you are helping me curate a particular kind of learning path based on the way that I learn, like as someone with ADHD, I learn in a very different way maybe than someone else. And I've loved the idea of using AI to really help me versus replace me. And I feel like that's where e-learning and education really, you know, that's where AI can really shine in that capacity.
So how do you weave that into a really positive customer experience in terms of, you know, is it up to the learner, the e-learner, to give it the prompts to say, like, you know, I'm dyslexic, I, you know, have this kind of learning style, these are the things that typically work for me, whether it's audio or visual. Who gives the prompts?
Right now, it's a combination of both. At Articulate, what we do is we curate a lot of the AI features and experiences to have this base from instructional design, or base from all the things that we've learned from our internal instructional designers, or from our users, or from our research and UX folks going out and actually talking to customers and really drawing in all that knowledge. So it's a balance between seeding it in a way that you do have kind of this curated institutional knowledge, and that's different than just going to ChatGPT, where you're just going to kind of get the base model and whatever OpenAI has put into it. So we add this kind of additional layer of expertise on top, both in how we develop the features and how we prompt the model, but then allow for that flexibility for the user to come in and then specify extra things that they want, or to change the way that their experience goes, to change the way they use the features. So that's kind of like the tug and pull that we are interested in, both as product people and as just users of the product, which is how do we make it useful to the user in our particular feature, but then also ensure that they have the flexibility to still get all that generalized goodness out of the big AI models that are out there right now.
So, Rich, it seems that you're working for a company that curates learning tools and course training materials. And so people are supposed to be learning from Articulate, but we also think about AI as also learning itself. So who's teaching who in your world?
I think it's a little bit of both. The difference between humans and AI right now is that if you want current AI tools to be able to remember something about you. You kind of have to force them to. So if I'm as a human, I'm learning something from AI, I'll have one conversation, I'll remember what happened in that conversation. And to some extent, you can do that with AI, but for the most part, these are static models, and any additional memory or recall that you bake into them has to kind of be put on top of everything else. You kind of have to go to the work and effort, and it's very imperfect. So I think it's a little bit of both, but right now humans have the advantage of we can continue to learn, and you know, the next day when I go to AI, I remember everything that it told me the day before, and now can go a little bit deeper. The AI is constantly having to be reminded of what it did wrong, constantly having to be corrected in a way that it won't learn again until the company decides to update its parameters. So I think it's a little bit of both, but the human side is learning in a much more fluid and iterative way.
Well, earlier you talked about something, and I'm not quite sure I grasp the concept, but I think you use the term reward. It's how we reward AI. Can you talk a little bit about what that is and how that affects how the AI operates?
Absolutely. So these days, these large language models, let's say like the GPT models that underpin OpenAI's ChatGPT, they are first trained on this massive data set, essentially the entire internet, with very few objectives. So they're just kind of trained to understand and learn and then sort of repeat itself. And that's the foundation of the language model, which is what we mean AI is what we mean a language model these days. Then they take it and then they add what we call instruction tuning. So then they take a smaller data set, very highly curated by experts or by internal data sets they create using their workers, where it now learns how to understand commands and instructions. So when you say like, give me an Excel sheet and this and that, that's happening in the second phase where it's really learning to understand and interpret human commands. The third stage is then they release it to users and they do what's called reinforcement learning with human feedback, which is they start giving you a little thumbs up and thumbs down if you've seen that on the ChatGPT interface. And then you're able to tell it whether it's response or good or not. And most of these very big models and most AI now in general has this third phase where they start rewarding the model for better responses based on what users give it or based on some, you know, other factors, like maybe it solves a math equation correctly. And so instead of just training on what exists, you're actually rewarding it and pushing it in different directions based on how humans are saying it's good or bad. And so that's the reward mechanism. That's where most of like a lot of the personalities where suddenly people are saying that, you know, ChatGPT is sycophantic, that's coming from the reward mechanism, where as users reward it more and more for telling people that they're awesome or telling people that their ideas are great, suddenly it just goes too far in that direction, kind of like, you know, unobstructed evolution. And now everything, it always tells you that you're amazing and awesome. And people are like, wait, hold on. I want a little bit of criticism. And so that's how like we're rewarding them is by, you know, the sort of like an algorithm on TikTok. Like the more you like it, the more people like it, the more likely you are to get responses similar to that.
Which is both human and also not human. I mean, if we get positive feedback for the way that we, you know, praise others, then as humans, we'll continue to do it until we find that it's not effective.
Right.
So, you know, in these learning models, you know, does AI learn from itself finding that it's not being as effective as it could, or does it need to be told, hey, wait a minute, you're kind of coming on too strong with the positivity?
It needs in some fashion to be told. It can't, there are sort of ways for these models to learn from themselves, but for the most part, it really is dictated by how we choose to either reward them or tell them they've done good or bad. So that it's very much always a reflection of what we're telling them to do, whether it's explicit, like literally in the training set, saying yes or no or good or bad answer, or implicit where we simply say that this response was a little bit better than that one. But either way, it's always a reflection of what we're telling it is good or bad.
Yeah. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Park City resident Richard Herbert. He is an artificial intelligence engineer. He works in a learning platform called Articulate. I'm curious about why you chose Park City. Did you work at Pluralsight here in Utah? And then when you changed over, you just decided, hey, Park City's a pretty nice place.
Pretty much exactly that. I actually grew up in Utah, then I moved, and then I came back when I was working for Pluralsight. The real reason we chose Park City is that my wife and I could not find an apartment building in Salt Lake that would take our dog, a German Shepherd. And so we found one in Park City, and then we're like, well, Park City is actually pretty awesome. Maybe this works out better. And then we've been there for the past 5 years.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, so, you know, I think there's this balance between the hype of AI, what we think it might be able to do and the reality of what it can do. And I know you talk about this a lot. You have this conversation about, you know, what is that? You know, where's the happy place in between? So could you comment on that? Like, what's not real? What is just overhyping it?
There are definitely fields or industries where workers are at risk. I think particularly in visual artists, voiceover actors, there are places where the hype of people getting replaced is real and existential in some capacity, at least for those professions. For the most part, though, the idea of AI replacing skilled workers in the sense that you're going to go from a team of five to a team of one, or you're going to go from a company of size X to a company of size X divided by however many, is relatively unrealistic at the moment. And the reason for that is AI is really good at a lot of things 80 to 90% of the time. And most folks don't realize how important that 10% it's missing is in terms of being able to build a business or be able to make independent decisions, particularly when there's more than one decision that needs to be made. So there's a recent article or blog post from another software engineer that came out that's going around Reddit and LinkedIn and other places where he talks about in a complex process, say like an engineering in my field, to deploy an agent, which is kind of the buzzword that people use to talk about these AI that might replace us. An agent in any real scenario might need to make 5 or 6 or 10 decisions by itself. And if it has a 95 or 99% error rate, then each one of those decisions, the error rate compounds, and then suddenly it's only actually 30% accurate. And there's all this research backed up from Salesforce, backed up from Carnegie Mellon, even backed up from like Anthropic and their own internal testing that suggests that the ability to just go and have an AI agent or AI do a human's job in any real capacity attached to business value is essentially something we may eventually get to, but has no real basis in reality right now, no matter how much CEOs and executives and companies really want it to be in terms of a cost-saving mechanism. So there's a lot of hype and a lot of exaggeration. I think that's the one that has the least attachment to reality at the moment.
Well, so it sounds like AI is evolving into something that I would maybe consider more of a colleague than a competitor.
I think you'll find that with a human in the loop who is already a relative expert in what they're trying to do, an AI can be a colleague, maybe an assistant, maybe a junior partner, and that they can help curate and help expedite tasks that still require your review. Maybe there's a few things they can do on their own that you've learned to trust them, but it still absolutely requires someone who knows what they're doing to sign off on the work that the AI has produced to be able to validate and verify. So whether it's a colleague or an assistant, I definitely think it's something that's going to help you if you know how to use it and if you're already knowledgeable in the area that you're trying to deploy it in.
I want to backtrack for a second about the concept of positive reward and AI kind of building on itself to create, I guess, a personality, for lack of a better word. And, you know, we've seen things on TV where AI is now coming out with, I guess, developing its own personality. And you have these animated characters that are built on AI that you can now actually interact with. I mean, I'm assuming that based on the positive reward mechanism that AI is built on my mother, who was always giving me positive feedback. But tell me a little bit more about the development of how we're building personalities actually into AI. How can I date my phone?
Well, it's becoming easier and easier. It used to be that you'd have to hard code all these personality traits. And this actually goes back to even the 60s, where there were chatbots, versions of these things that could fool folks even back then into believing they were talking to a human. So a little bit of it is just the smoke and mirrors of psychology, of being able to phrase things in a certain way, give the illusion of sentience, the illusion of personality, because we so eagerly attach linguistic skills and language itself to personality and intelligence. But these days, I can take a prompt. In fact, I've done this recently, and I can describe the type of personality I want the AI to assume. And just using my own tools and my own computer, I can basically get it to do it just by giving it a personality, saying, act like this. And it, you know, here's the phrases you can use. Here's the types of ways to respond. And with a few sentences or a couple of paragraphs, I can create my own personality. So it's easier than ever because these bots are so well tuned to taking instruction and to knowing how to interpret our intentions and to understand what we want from them, that it's only a couple of paragraphs and an API subscription. Now I can kind of get whatever personality I want talking to me in real time.
What you're talking about, Rich, makes me think about a conversation we had a couple of years ago, and I'm wondering if it's still the same. You know, you as a software developer and engineer are now training AI in the way that you want to train it. But as you just said, it really depends on the kinds of, you know, linguistic talents that you have, right? And so a couple of years ago, we had this conversation like, oh, there's going to be so many more jobs for English majors, for example, you know, the humanities to enter into this realm of AI. Have you found that to be true? Or do you need to have the skill set that you have accrued in your 10 years of designing and developing software?
I think the best way I've heard it described is there's a barrier of entry now to utilizing machine learning AI tools that didn't exist before. So before, to even use AI, unless it was put into a product that someone had already developed, it was very difficult to access that. So you might take someone like me who knows how to find the models and how to put them into a software product, how to update them. But the access to simply utilizing these more general purpose AI that can assume different personalities, that can assume roles, responsibilities, is so easy that the lines are definitely very blurred. If I want to have my own AI in my product that isn't attached to one of these bigger companies, like if I don't want to call out and hand my data to them, then you still need someone, you know, with a skill set like me being able to either host open source version of these models in the product or, you know, develop adapters or layers on top of them to more specially personalize them. But for the most part, if you want to go out and start getting a lot of the benefits from AI that might have taken an expert like me in the past, the barrier for entry is much, much lower and doesn't require having software engineering skills. It still might require a little bit of expertise in whatever you're trying to do with it. But for the most part, you can sit down at a computer and access a lot of the same things that I was getting paid to do 7 or 8 years ago.
Yeah, that's wild. Do you ever fear for your own job, or have you figured out enough about how you as a human with the skills you have, that you're needed and you will be needed?
I think it's the same thing that WordPress and HTML site builders didn't kill front-end developers, didn't kill off the professions of folks who still need folks to come in and code more complex things. The thing is that the targets always get moved. So sure, that we have what we think of now as like so advanced in 10 years will not seem that advanced. And there's still always people needed to push the envelope, people needed who are experts in knowing how to tweak them. There's lots of folks with data privacy concerns that really need these models to be hosted within their own environment to stay, so the data stays on site, which means you can't use the ones that already exist. So there's all these different edge cases and advancements that, no, I'm not too worried about my job right now.
Yeah, well, because we'd love to have you stick around, and particularly here in Park City.
Right.
It's just such a great thing having you so local. I guess one last question. I mean, in our prior interview with Blaze, he felt pretty much the same way you're articulating now, no pun intended on articulate, but that no matter how sophisticated AI gets or machine learning, you will always need some human to direct it. There will always be some ability for the software engineer or the machine learning experts to give AI direction, because while you can say, for example, hey, I want you to solve a Wordle puzzle, well, that doesn't mean anything to AI unless you give it the parameters. So given that your job and others will always be to give parameters, does that give you some sense of job security, for lack of a better word?
I think so. I think that until how we build AI changes very drastically, there's still quite a lot of expertise involved in updating the models. There's even some expertise involved in using the models in different contexts. It's just like it takes a skill to develop Photoshop, right? Like if you want to go and use Photoshop really well, there's some things you can do without learning a lot, and there's some things you can't do until you've spent 10, 20, 30, and more hours with it. So I think even from the usage perspective, there's going to be a lot of expertise required. And then, yes, until we develop an actual brain with motivations and the ability to make decisions on its own, the ability to understand and have opinions of its own, we're still going to be required to give it all of that and curate it in a very specific way. So right now, I'm not seeing any future that's realistic and where human expertise is not involved or very, very necessary in getting these models to be as useful as they are.
So, Rich, I guess the last word is that Lynn and I can feel relatively secure that our jobs are safe for now.
So far.
Hey, Rich, before we let you go, for our listeners, I'm just curious, if you look up Articulate, can the end consumer just, engage with the platform and find courses there? What will our listeners take away from this that they can use in their everyday lives?
Well, the users can go to Articulate and they can sign up and they can review some of the template courses we have and then understand, play around with how they might build their own courses, play around with the AI assistant and how it can help them understand instructional design, how they can learn a little bit about how to educate and how to teach in different contexts. So absolutely, free trial can always go on and play around. You can download Storyline if you want that more like hands-on experience with a lot more control. You can just jump on and start learning and start teaching.
That's great. Let's see. Oh, is Storyline kind of the AI version of kind of PowerPoint? Did I read that?
Storyline is the course creator version of PowerPoint. It's been around for a very long time, I think 15 or 16 or even longer years now. And now we've integrated our AI assistant into it. So it's kind of like a PowerPoint on steroids that now has this AI assistant really geared to building courses and knowing how to help you teach learners in different contexts using different tools.
Oh, that's so great. How many times have you heard that death by PowerPoint? People just got so stuck with things, tools like that in their job sites. So how wonderful that we can, evolve this and keep learning and make it exciting for everyone.
Absolutely.
Well, Rich Herbert has been our guest today. He is a Park City resident, and he is a machine learning and artificial intelligence engineer. He is at the e-learning software company Articulate. Is Articulate based anywhere here?
It's a fully 100% remote company and has always been. So we're probably incorporated somewhere, but we're not based anywhere.
Okay, great. Based just where your dog is.
Exactly.
Thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for tuning into Cool Science Radio. If you like this episode, be sure to listen in each week and download previous episodes. You can find episodes at kpcw.org, under the Shows tab on kpcw.app, or wherever you get your podcasts at KPCW Cool Science Radio. And listen, if you have any ideas for future episodes, please email us at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org. And if you like today's episode, rate us, leave us a comment, subscribe to the show, and share it with your friends. We really do appreciate your input.